Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on tonight. As you know, it's been a busy week. We had a function on Monday with Australia's ambassador to the United Nations, Dennis Richardson. We had a function on yesterday with the editor at large of the New Republic. And tonight we've got Chris Lowney. It's not hard to distract. So, firstly, I should say thanks to Minter Ellison for providing this function this evening, this function place this evening, and thanks to the Loyola Institute for making it possible. They brought our speaker to Australia, and there's some blurb about the Loyola Institute on the front desk here if you want it later on. Chris Lowney is a former Jesuit. He worked for J.P. Morgan for 17 years, serving as managing director in New York, Tokyo, Singapore and London. He currently lives in New York City, where he is a consultant for the Catholic Medical Mission Board. He's got a website, of course, www.chrislowney.com, and he's the author of Heroic Leadership, Best Practices from a 450-year-old Company That Changed the World. And not many companies are 450 years old except the Jesuit Order, founded by Ignatius of Loyola. So, Chris Lowney, welcome, and thanks for talking for us tonight on heroic leadership. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the kind introduction, and thanks to Sydney Institute and to Minter Ellison as well. And I think I am supposed to talk for about 30 minutes, so I'll try to hit my mark as close as possible. And let me start right in then. So, who are our leaders? Why don't we begin with just a little mental experiment? Everybody take a few seconds, and let's all think quietly of the names of one or two living people that you would consider to be leaders. Now, in a typical group, people might be thinking of political leaders. You're here in this country, or my president, George Bush. I wonder who here is thinking of their own name. It's no one. We're raised in a culture that prizes humility, and humility is a beautiful virtue, and so we tend not to think of ourselves as leaders. But I want to suggest that in this case, that humility might be a little misplaced, because it's connected to a broken idea that associates leadership only with being in charge, being president, general, chief executive. And in some respects, the first people we need to think about as leaders are ourselves. Now, what do good leaders do to motivate the people around them? Let's make that part two of our little mental experiment. Let's all take a few more seconds and think of the qualities or behaviors that we all associate with leading well. I have no doubt people are thinking of a rich list of qualities, ideas like honor, courage, decisiveness. I wonder if anybody is thinking of this idea enunciated by someone who compiled unimpeachable leadership credentials and in his retirement speech said, "You must love those you lead before you can be an effective leader." What business do you think this guy was in? In fact, I just quoted General Eric Shinseki, who until a few years ago was chief of staff, highest-ranking military officer in the United States. And that sentiment, love those you lead, at first struck me as quite strange, coming from a military class that we associate with toughness. Or maybe not out of place. The more I thought about it, the more I suspect that generals make wiser choices. If they love the people, they must place in harm's way. And I also bet that soldiers perform better if they believe they're valued in some deep way by the people given the awful burden of sending them out possibly to face their death. So, who's a leader, and how are leaders leading? Well, we're all leading. well or poorly, all the time. And our claim to leadership is not our status in an organization, but who we are and the kinds of values we're willing to role model. Now, this notion of leadership certainly runs counter to stereotype, but it's not like a gimmick or something I make up. I think, actually, John Cotter from Harvard was in Melbourne a couple of days ago, somebody was telling me, and he used to talk about leadership as having three dimensions, that leaders first have some sense of vision, some idea of the future, this is where we need to go. And second, leaders get a group of people to buy in, to agree. And finally, leaders help people get past the obstacles that come up whenever you're trying to do something difficult. And one of the dictionary definitions of leadership is very similar. It talks about leadership as, quote, the act of pointing out a way, direction, or goal, and influencing others. Now, isn't it true that everyone here is living those words all the time? We're pointing out a way of living, by virtue of who we hire, how we run meetings. Many people here are parents. Could there be any more obvious example of pointing out a way and influencing others than what parents do for children over a lifetime? So by the dictionary definition, not like some gimmick of mine, good parenting is good leadership. Now, though all of us are leading, most of us are leading only subconsciously, you know, and to lead well, we all need to get a little more explicit, a little more purposeful. First, about the fact that we're leading, and second, about the specific kind of leadership impact we want to make with our lives. And in the course of my time, I want to talk about one model, not the model, one idea of leading that's drawn from two experiences in my own life. As you've heard, I was fortunate enough to work at J.P. Morgan for about 17 years. Before that, I was a Jesuit seminarian. I could summarize my life for you this way. For 7 years, I struggled successfully to live as a celibate. And ever since then, I've been struggling not to be a celibate. You may conclude that this book, therefore, is a cheaper way to figure out my own life than going into therapy. And you might be right. But, you know, what more struck me than the completely obvious differences in mission between a religious order and an investment bank were underlying similarities. Because isn't it true that all humans and all organizations have to accomplish the same kinds of tasks? We have to figure out goals and meet them. We have to conceive ideas and sell them to other people. We have to motivate ourselves and others. And it struck me that these 16th and 17th century priests did a lot of these things in ways that frankly were more effective than the ways we're trying to do them today, and that some of the values or principles we associate with leading well are enduring and are relevant whether you're in a nonprofit organization or an investment bank. And for such ideals or values, it strikes me are self-awareness, ingenuity, heroism, and love. I'm going to define all of them, and then I'll try to talk perhaps about all four if we have time. So first, self-awareness. To lead well, you have to know yourself. What are my strengths and weaknesses, my values, my outlook in the world? And second is ingenuity. The world is going to keep changing. And only people who are willing to adapt are leading. Third is heroism, that we motivate ourselves and other people with real ambition, with a passion to excel, with goals that are bigger than myself. And finally, love, that we treat other people in a way that respects their human dignity and tries to unlock their potential. Okay, now let me start with heroism. And I want to talk about two dimensions of what it means to be heroic, one having to do with dedication, another having to do with purpose bigger than self. If we had a little mental experiment and asked people to think of heroic moments, people would think of ideas like saving comrades on battlefields and saving people in burning buildings, and of course that is a unique sort of heroism. But the only thing in life that none of us can control ultimately is what opportunities life presents us. None of us know if we would ever be called on to save someone in distress. The only thing we always control is how we react and behave in front of whatever opportunities life presents. And for most of us, our opportunities are small, and our heroism is something we don't win in a spectacular moment of glory, but something we win over the course of a lifetime. Some of us here know Jesuits as educators, their most renowned work. And, you know, think of the work of teachers, right? I mean, teachers have no guarantee that they would ever make a profound impact in a student's life. Teachers' heroism is living and working every day as if they might make this kind of impact. Teachers also appreciate that the school works when everybody tries to serve the overall mission or project that is a school. This is another kind of dimension of heroism, and to illustrate it further, let me draw on an anecdote about President Kennedy in the United States in the early 1960s. Remember, the United States is trying to get a rocket ship to the moon before the Russians. You know, and the story goes that President Kennedy has a tour of the space agency, and at the end of it ends up in an office where a janitor is cleaning up. And to be polite, I guess, says, "Okay, so what's your job here?" And the guy says to him, "Mr. President, I'm putting a man on the moon." "Okay, I'm from New York City. We don't want any part of this team spirit stuff, you know. But even I know, and everyone here knows, the teams that perform best, whether it's my old J.P. Morgan, the Jesuits, your organizations, are teams where people get over themselves and appreciate that ultimately this is not about me. But there's a project here that we all show up and are willing to give some part of our ego to help serve." You know, some of you maybe are familiar with corporate culture and performance. You know, John Cotter and one of his colleagues did a study of a lot of high-performing and poor-performing companies. And one of the interesting things they found about high-performing companies is that it's a group of people who tend to be thinking always of someone else. How do we serve shareholders? How do we serve customers? How do I make the people on my team more productive? And in lousy companies, you find people by and large thinking of themselves. How do I use my customers to extract maximum profit? How do I use my employees to look good myself? So, you know, in this ultimate for-profit environment, people who are doing well have some kind of sense of purpose beyond self. You know, Good to Great, maybe, Jim Collins' work, right? And he talks about level five leaders, the highest rank of leaders, as people who are ambitious first and foremost for the cause, the organization, the work, not themselves. So we have a lot of kind of mounting evidence that places are doing well when people are able to adapt a mentality that I'm calling heroic, that includes having some sense of purpose that's beyond your own ego. But what none of these pundits are telling us is, well, how am I going to get there? How do people cultivate this kind of mindset? And for me, that's a self-awareness job. And so now let me talk a little bit about self-awareness as a leadership value. When I was a Jesuit, and in fact, every Jesuit in history has gone through during training this month-long period of introspection called the spiritual exercises. And during this time, these guys are taken away completely from job responsibilities, and no telephone, no newspaper. His only job for a month is to think about himself and his religious vocation. Now, for these guys, there's a religious discipline, of course. But I also see a wonderful leadership boot camp there. Because each of these guys is being forced to think about who am I, and what's ultimately worth doing in life, and what am I good at and bad at. Anybody who's managed a lot of people or worked in a human resources department, I've done both, has been mystified by this phenomenon of rising corporate stars who suddenly burn out. So, you know, at J.P. Morgan, we used to hire basically the smartest kids in America because they all, you know, want to come to investment banks and get rich, you know. And invariably, they all would do very well when the only thing we asked them to do is move numbers around spreadsheets. And also invariably, some portion of them would blow up as soon as we asked them to do, you know, grown-up things, like dealing with other human beings or, you know, dealing with problems that don't have easy solutions. And you may know there's one school of thought that attributes these spectacular flameouts to lack of self-awareness. In other words, what sometimes happens is that very smart people quite quickly figure out how to do school, how to master the rote set of tasks that often go with schooling, but they never figure out how to do life because they've never really been exposed to the kind of challenges or failures or setbacks that gave them what in the corporate world we used to call learning agility. There's an emeritus psychologist at Harvard, Abraham Zelsnick, who worked with a lot of corporate CEOs and made a very interesting observation that a disproportionate share of those he knew were, in his words, twice born. Very interesting choice of words, although he didn't mean it the way we'd intuitively think. What he observed was how many of them had suffered in their early adulthood some kind of a crisis. You're bankrupt, you're alcoholic, you get fired, your marriage breaks up. And this experience totally knocked them down and made them say, you know, look, who am I and what do I want out of my life? And his thesis as a psychologist was that it was exactly that moment that explained their ultimate success, because it gave them a sense of drive and a sense of focus for the long term. And what I'm saying is this, that if life doesn't thrust on us through a crisis, some moment of self-scrutiny, we all need to manufacture for ourselves some way of foundationally coming to grips with as adults, with who we are and what we value and how we're going to work. Jesuits also learned during this month-long period a wonderful tool for daily updating that anybody here can begin using tomorrow in less than 10 minutes a day. The founder of the Jesuits, Ignatius, says, okay, every day we need to make three little mental pit stops. When you wake up in the morning, remind yourself, what do I have to be grateful for as a person? And think of some objective you want to achieve or some personal issue you need to work on. And he says two more times during the day, go through a similar process. Let's imagine lunchtime, I have a few minutes. And first step always, why am I grateful? And second, what is it I want to be working on these days? And third, replay the videotape of the last few hours mentally and try to take away some lesson that will help you in the next few hours. I think the genius of this very simple process is very obvious when we think about its origins. When the Jesuits were starting in the 16th century, almost all religious orders were what we today would call monastic in character. In other words, all the monks and nuns, or nuns, would go off to chapel multiple times each day together to pray in common. And Jesuits wanted to pursue much more activist occupations that really wouldn't allow them all to go off to chapel together, right? We have wonderful Jesuit schools here in Australia, like St. Aloysius, St. Ignatius, and Riverview. How well would those schools work if three or four times a day the whole administration and staff just disappeared? Maybe better? But Ignatius had this great insight in the 16th century that we're forgetting in the 21st. You know, it's very easy for us to dispense with a routine like heading off to chapel together. What we can't dispense with is a human need to get ourselves refocused as we bob along all day on this tide of email, meeting, phone call. And we get to the end of the workday and haven't gotten to our number one priority, and or we have a meeting go badly at 8:30 in the morning, and the whole rest of the day I'm saying, oh gee, wish I said this at 8:30, and we're losing productivity, you know. And these spiritual tools, in a way, give us very interesting self-awareness benefits. You know, by the way, Loyola Institute was mentioned in the introduction here. This is not a paid commercial, I'm just saying what I think. Loyola Institute is dedicating itself exactly to this kind of space. In other words, to help people use some of these self-awareness techniques, especially people who are working in professional or business capacity and trying to figure out how we're going to kind of create whole lives for ourselves, apply our beliefs to our work, and so on. And I think that there's some brochures over there, maybe, and so I think it'd be wonderful, those who are interested in discussing further, to get in touch with them. In any case, that was free. So heroism, self-awareness. I'm going to talk for a little less time about ingenuity, because usually it's intuitively clear to people that the world is changing very fast, and we all somehow need to be a little adaptive in order to survive. And what in the world are 16th century priests possibly going to tell us in the 21st century about how to be change adaptive? And I think that the answer to that question is in one of these self-awareness meditations of Ignatius. He says, imagine that you inherit a huge amount of money. What should you do with it? Well, okay, so this is like St. Ignatius who wrote this meditation, so we say, well, I guess the right answer is to give the money to poor people and rejoice piously. And, well, maybe that's a very good thing to do, but in fact it's the wrong answer to the meditation. He says that the first thing we need to do is to make ourselves free. We would say strategically free. To pursue all of the legitimate options. I can either keep the money or give the money away. And only when I'm free to pursue all alternatives am I in a position to make a good choice, a good decision. And then I choose according to whatever is my goal, my mission in life. Now, that sounds a little abstract. Let me talk about it in a very concrete way. I know some of the people in this room have been involved in a merger and acquisition business at one point or another. And anybody who's been in that business knows that there are wonderful would-be mergers that never happen. Deals that would be good for shareholders, good for customers. Why not? We're going through the negotiating process, and my brother here is chief executive of one of the companies, and my sister here is chief executive of the other company, and it comes to a certain point where we're going to have to decide who's going to be chief executive of the shared company. And nobody is willing to accept the fact that he or she is going to have to be number two. So in the terms of this meditation, each of these folks is so attached to their own ego that they can't make a good choice. And look, this is what reality is like, huh? I mean, we're going through life in all kinds of organizations with all kinds of these attachments to our own status in companies. We're attached to fear. We don't want to do something differently because we've been doing it this way for 10 years. We're attached to our prejudices about other people. We've been here a dozen years, and here's this new person with new ideas. How good could they be? And how do we get more risk-adaptive, more creative, more flexible? We tend in big companies just to tell people the world is changing fast. You got to change. And they're just getting more and more afraid and hunkering down. You know, part of the issue of becoming change-ready is just to understand what inside, what kind of attachments are holding us back. Okay, heroism, self-awareness, ingenuity. Let me move on to the value about which people in a big company often would be the most skeptical, what place could love possibly have in a big company. I assure you I didn't wander the hallways of J.P. Morgan embracing my colleagues, telling them I love them. Nor am I suggesting you start showing each other the love in your respective enterprises. But Ignatius said that love ought to manifest itself in deeds, not in words. So what kind of deeds could show the impact of love in a workplace? How about this for starters, for love in a workplace with clear bottom line impact? Surely, no chief executive who loved his or her employees would have recklessly gambled their pensions and careers in order to prop up his stock option value through fraud, like these morons at Enron. Now, I think this is a completely legitimate example. If you're entrusted with other human beings as colleagues or subordinates, what do you owe them simply because they're human? Everyone here knows that children learn better and perform more effectively when they feel safe, and when people make them know they're valuable, and when people instill discipline. And have we ever convinced ourselves that our adult needs are different? You know, the best teams I was ever on at Morgan were teams where we trusted each other. We're more interested in helping each other win than watching each other lose. We didn't stab each other in the back, and we held each other very accountable to the kind of high standards that made each person and the whole team better performing. Now, I think we could call a bundle of behaviors like this love in a workplace setting if part of the motivation is that these people I'm alongside are not like tools, like hammers for me to use and throw away, but people have a unique kind of dignity that ought to be respected. We ought even to think of what is the concept of the very word company, right? We all associate company with commercial enterprise only, and we all use a word like Jesuits to refer to Jesuits. In their own language, the founders of this organization called themselves a company. Even today, if you go to a Latin-speaking country, South America, it would be La Compañía de Jesús, the company of Jesus. And in their minds, the word company would have had a very different connotation. Those who remember their Latin or Romance languages remember that the word company is two words, right? The word for with or together, and the word for bread. So who is your company? Your company ought to be the group of people with whom you want to break bread. A group of people that gives you energy, not a group of people that takes your energy away. The word companion, of course, is the same word, right? The same roots. And so in a sense, their 16th century challenge to us is to make our modern places a little more companionable, a little closer to this original vision of what a company is and ought to be. Now, I talk about this this idea of love in a workplace, not because I'm a nice guy and I want everybody to be nice, but for, very, I would consider, tough, hard-headed reasons, you know. Those who pay attention to any know that in the United States, for example, in these surveys of people working in for-profit organizations, rare that more than 50% of people will say they are happy with their work. And only about 40% of people will say they trust their own manager. And about half of people say they worry frequently about losing their jobs. Now, nobody can possibly believe that this kind of environment is the environment in which people are delivering maximum bottom line productivity. And so part of my claim is that we need to think of and be willing to step up and work in a different kind of way that, of course, is going to respect people's dignity, but also is going to give us better productivity at the end of the day. In the course of the last two decades, we've gone through continuous rounds of delayering to try and get more and more productive in major enterprises, right? And we've now built these companies middle managers, for the most part, have such a wide span of control that people can't even know what their subordinates are doing all day, much less give close guidance, supervision, and support. So we've built environments that call for a tremendous amount of self-leadership. But we really don't have a lot of people who feel comfortable enough operating within the environments we've created. And so in a way, we need to kind of think of a different way of what it means to lead and help people to perform better in those environments. Let me just take a couple of minutes to sum up, and then I'll look forward to the conversation, and I think I'll hit my 30-minute mark. So first, I hope you take away a kind of fundamentally different concept about what it could mean to lead. We all tend to associate leadership with status, the position we hold in an organization, or tactics, things we do to other people to manipulate them into doing what we want them to do. And certainly we could project leadership through status, but more fundamentally, it's about who we are. And so we all ought to spend a little more time to lead well, thinking about ourselves, a little less time, trying to imitate Donald Trump. And, how do we lead well? Well, we all need to make some kind of a foundational investment in ourselves as leaders, and we all need to have some kind of a mechanism to keep ourselves updated every day on how we're doing. Popular culture is, and this is work, to do that. Popular culture is suggesting to us that I'm going to go to the airport in Sydney and, buy some little book. And by the time the shuttle lands in Melbourne, I've memorized a few rules and I'll be a better leader. It's total nonsense. And we all know it is. It was my privilege to work with terrific leaders on four continents. And with